It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, 100 years of the Red Cross in Iowa. Later on in the hour, we'll talk about the role of the Red Cross in Iowa today. We'll also hear the stories of two of the Red Cross's Heroes of the Heartland honorees. But first, we're going to focus on the history of the organization. And with me now is Kara Kelly, Regional Communication Officer for the American Red Cross. Hello, Kara.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us. We're excited to be here.
And also with me is historian Tom Moraine. He is director of government relations and teaches at Graceland University in Lamoni. Hello, Tom.
Hello to you.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And we want to go back 100 years to 1916 when the Red Cross came to Iowa. And Kara, I'll start with you. Can you tell me a little bit about really what the Red Cross was back in 1916?
Of course. And really, when you think about the Red Cross in Iowa, it actually goes back a bit farther than 1916. Clara Barton actually shipped cornmeal and flour to Russia to help with the famine there from Iowa back in 1892. So really a lot of rich history with Clara Barton and, of course, the Red Cross.
But and for people who haven't done their history research, Clara Barton is the founder of the Red Cross, and she really started her good work during the Civil War.
That's correct. That's correct. So I would say the Red Cross really started getting a lot of enthusiasm around it with the U.S.'s involvement in World War One, and the first nationally recognized chapter of the Red Cross was established in Cedar Falls, and then that quickly just kind of picked up some momentum there with seven other chapters formed shortly thereafter. But, you know, the Red Cross has a rich history in working in disaster relief, of course. But really, I would say the momentum was really built up around the war effort.
All right. And Tom, let's take everybody back to 1916 in Iowa, because the United States didn't join World War One until 1917. But the war was raging in 1916. And, of course, everybody was watching. What were things like?
Well, you're right. We didn't enter until 1917. And I think it's interesting. The Red Cross was founded as a nonpartisan effort. When it first got going, it would help anyone who needed it, regardless of what side they were on in a conflict. And there was evidence in Iowa that Iowans contributed to the Red Cross to help either German or French or British soldiers or anyone who was in the conflict who needed assistance. If the Red Cross could get it to them, they were not just for one side or the other. Of course, when the United States began being pro-ally and then entered the war against Germany, all of our efforts were targeted at France and England. But I think it's very admirable for the Red Cross, and their dominant effort has been who needs help, not do we support the political side of one or the other. And I think that's very admirable for the Red Cross.
And of course, going back to 1916, as we've talked about on this program a number of times, Tom, there were a lot of Germans in Iowa. And as World War One was heating up, tensions were rising between people who were of German descent and other people living in Iowa, right?
That's right. And particularly pockets of the state that had strong German elements, there were people who there were German citizens who got roughed up, who got their loyalty questioned. And some of them were very pro-German, very obviously pro-German. And that was not a popular thing during World War One. But I don't see the anti-German sentiment in Red Cross support. It was, who can we help? Once we entered the war, we wanted to help the Allies.
Right.
But it was a helping effort, and not let's get somebody who we don't like.
Well, and I was wondering if the people who were farsighted enough to say, okay, we need to bring the Red Cross to Iowa, I wondered if they were reacting to those tensions and thinking maybe this is a way we can bring people together.
No, I don't think the timeline would do that. We were sending support internationally before we entered the war. So it wasn't we're going to use this to ameliorate tensions. I think it was a true humanitarian effort.
Okay.
One of the things, let me jump in. One of the sure. things that I really think is a good use of history to reflect on who we are today, a couple things. One is how much the military and the government depended on volunteer activities, the types of things the Red Cross, it was not just raising money, although that was big. They opened centers where women primarily and children would come in and knit sweaters and knit mufflers and knit socks for the soldiers, and then those would be sent. And later the sewing rooms where they would sew clothing for soldiers, and rolling bandages and scraping lint off fabric to get padding and dressings for soldiers. The United States Army said, we need supplies, and rather than going out and buying them commercially, they looked to groups like the Red Cross for citizen participation in supplying them. And then what that also did, and I think it's such a difference from today, we can have a war and there will be very little direct connection of U.S. citizens to where soldiers are fighting. But in World War I, many, many people volunteered in one way or another to support the troops. It really brought the nation itself into the conflict, with people feeling they had a personal contribution to make. And I think that's an interesting contrast with today.
Absolutely. Well, and I can imagine, especially as the United States entered the war, it was a place for people on the home front to focus their energy as they worried about the soldiers that they loved.
That's right. And it was a personal connection. I have a story from Jefferson that I love. Women would put personal notes in the socks that they knit to soldiers, and they would give their address if the soldier wanted to write and say thank you, or the soldier wanted to make a connection. They would have the address of someone they could write to thank for their socks. But one man told me about a friend of his in the Army, because he was in World War I when I interviewed him, and the note that went back to the woman who knit it said, the left one's too large, the right one don't fit. Who in hell taught you how to knit?
Oh, no.
I suppose that's not what she was expecting from
no.
the soldiers. But there was a personal connection between knitter and soldier, and rolling those bandages and knowing they would help somebody. It wasn't just giving money. And I think that total war effort, I want to be involved, is something that the Red Cross did very well to mobilize.
Well, and Kara, as these different units of the Red Cross were opening around the state of Iowa, can you tell me how they grew? I mean, I'm sure that they probably started in people's living rooms, but how did things snowball?
They really started with, you know, maybe a couple of folks who decided to get involved. And then you're right, they would just kind of grow their membership. What was interesting about that time was that you would actually pay to become a member of the Red Cross. And that was one of the ways that they did raise money to help support the war effort and also disaster relief. These workrooms that Tom was talking about were really incredible. The mostly women would get together and make supplies, just as he said. One of the more unique places we discovered that they had one of these workrooms was in the bar room of the Julian Hotel in Dubuque, because they couldn't use it because of prohibition. So, you know, really unique places. And then that actually became a model as one of the workrooms that was very productive. And they would send people from Dubuque across the state to show other communities how to get going and to ship off more supplies. And the war fund efforts were just a huge community effort. And what I think is really interesting, and Leslie, who you'll hear from later, we were talking about this, about the way they would really lean on people in order to raise money. Some of their slogans were, you know, if you haven't given till it hurts, you haven't given enough. And give your money willingly and do it now, which is not willingly. And but it worked. You know, in 1917, the War Fund in Iowa raised $1.2 million, which at that time, it's an incredible amount of money now, let alone then.
How did Iowa compare to other states in their Red Cross efforts?
We were actually leading the pack in a lot of ways. Not only did we have the largest number of chapters, Des Moines actually led the country in the number of members, at least based on population for a while, especially in 1917. So as always, and I think this speaks to Iowans, I mean, they have huge hearts. They want to help their neighbors. They want to help folks who need it. And the Iowans really rallied together in their communities to support.
Well, Tom, yes.
Let me jump in with there, because I think I like what she said about the collecting and the community involvement. I know from my study of Jefferson, the women of Jefferson, the Women's Club, organized themselves to go door-to-door canvassing for the Red Cross. In one country school, they had a box social, and it was to raise money for the Red Cross. And 4th of July, they had picnic and concessions. And games that the public was invited to, and it was to raise money for the Red Cross. That involvement and that enthusiasm for how can we help, I think speaks very well for Iowa, but I think it was a reflection nationally that there was a very personal connection with the war effort, and certainly the Red Cross was able to tap into that for a beneficial cause.
Now, the early Red Cross focus was on the war effort and on aiding soldiers, but there was also a focus on helping Iowans as well. Kara?
Absolutely. So the Red Cross was still very strong and really actually got its foundation within helping in disaster relief, and then switched over to the war effort, of course, when World War I was happening. But, you know, we did have some very severe storms that happened in 1918.
And we can talk just a little bit about that after the break. I hope you can both stay with me for a few more minutes as we talk about the history of the Red Cross while we're recognizing the organization in its 100th year in Iowa. With me, Kara Kelly, Regional Communications Officer for the American Red Cross, and Tom Moraine of Graceland University in Lamoni. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are marking the 100th year of the Red Cross in Iowa. And right now, we're focusing on the history of the organization. With me, Kara Kelly, Regional Communications Officer for the American Red Cross, and Tom Moraine, historian and also Director of Government Relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. And just before the break, we were talking about disaster relief in the state of Iowa, Kara. And you mentioned that we had, two deadly tornadoes in 1918 that the Red Cross stepped in to help those in need, right?
That's correct. Very deadly tornado outbreak in May of 1918. And the Red Cross was there in all the communities that were affected, providing, you know, food, clothing, shelter, and other immediate needs, which is what we do today. So really something that the Red Cross is known for, and making sure that people are taken care of when they're in an hour of need.
As time went on, the Red Cross also started focusing efforts on some of the things that, of course, we're familiar with the Red Cross for, but education efforts, such as teaching people how to do first aid. And when did that begin, CPR, first aid education for the public?
First aid training and education really started growing in the 1920s and focused, of course, a lot on the nursing efforts, but worked with public service and law enforcement entities, but really kicked off in the 1920s and then grew into that and, of course, grew into water safety training as well.
Tom?
The nursing education in the 1920s just sort of tipped over back into 1919, too, and the end of 1918 with the flu epidemic that came really hard at the end of World War One, and the Red Cross provided public health nursing and domestically while they were still wrapping up affairs at the end of World War One. But it was a dual whammy, both the war and the domestic public health efforts that created by the flu epidemic at the end of 1918.
I want to ask about blood donation, because again, that's something that a lot of us associate with the Red Cross. When did that begin? Kara?
Oh, excuse me. So blood donation really started kind of also with the war effort. It really appears as such, you know, blood donation pretty started kind of in the 1930s and really took off toward in the 40s and toward World War II.
All right. And of course, the blood donation effort continues through today as part of the service of the Red Cross. And there was a group of women who really got blood donation off the ground in the state. They were called the Gray Ladies. Tom, can you tell me about them?
I'm not up.
Okay. Kara, maybe you can. I'm not sure which one of you. Kara?
Well, the Gray Ladies were really an interesting group, as they were kind of a humanitarian nurse, if you will. And they worked with the soldiers and the wounded to do things that were not health related. So they might write letters or help with making sure that they had shoes and supplies. And it was really, they were called the Gray Ladies because of the color of their uniforms, which is interesting because we actually have one of those uniforms in our archives in the office in Des Moines. But they were really a humanitarian group. You know, the Red Cross has always been known for the nurses. This was a different group who really helped the soldiers with things that weren't health or medically related.
Interesting. Well, Tom Moraine, thank you so much for being here today to help us learn about the history of the Red Cross in Iowa.
My pleasure. And if you want to help with your fundraising, you might have a box social. Everyone bring one.
It's a brilliant plan. That'll change everything. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, former administrator of the Iowa State Historical Society. He currently teaches at Graceland University and serves at the university's Director of Government Relations. Of course, Kara Kelly is still with me, Regional Communications Officer for the American Red Cross. And I want to bring Leslie Schaefer into the conversation, Regional Executive Director for the American Red Cross. Hello, Leslie.
Hi, Charity.
And since we were just talking about blood donations in the Red Cross, of course, that's something that's still a very important part of the Red Cross's mission today. Can you give me an idea of how significant the Red Cross is in that role?
Sure. The American Red Cross actually provides 40% of the blood supply in the United States. And here in Iowa, we collect about 40,000, maybe a little bit more, units of blood.
Okay. And of course, that's such an important mission, but it's also something that is constantly challenging. I mean, we've heard about Zika virus in the news a lot. How does the Red Cross deal with these new possible contaminants in our blood supply?
Well, that's a great question. And of course, the Red Cross, as the leading provider, is always on the cutting edge of those issues. And right now, we're certainly following the guidance given to us by the FDA and the Centers of Disease Control. And right now, what we're asking for those folks that do want to give blood is that as they come into the process, if they've been in the countries where we do have Zika active, that they not donate at this time, and that they give it 4 weeks to determine if they do have the virus.
You mentioned the numbers and how significant blood donation is in Iowa and blood donation through the Red Cross. Is it a challenge to continue to find donors?
Actually, I think we have some very active donors. These are folks that want to do good, and it's a way that they can help. And actually, I'm one of those folks that is an O negative donor, and I think Nancy, who we're going to hear from soon, is an O negative donor, so we're in high demand.
All right. Now, and I want to talk a little bit about, before we bring Nancy into the conversation, about what the Red Cross does now, because there are a lot of people who really only see the Red Cross at the blood donation centers. What do you feel the focus is of the organization in 2016?
Well, you know, our focus remains the same, kind of what Kara and Tom were describing, and that is disaster response. But certainly, we're expanding our view here in Iowa into preparedness. And so one of our big initiatives this year is smoke alarm installations. And we want folks to be safe in their homes. And so we are actually undertaking an effort to install 5,000 smoke alarms throughout Iowa, just in this, actually in probably the next 3 months or so. And this is a really exciting initiative for us. And not only are we installing smoke alarms, but as we go door to door, we're teaching people how to prepare for disaster, but also have an escape plan for their family.
And we will talk about disaster relief a little bit more in a moment. But before I introduce Nancy Kittner, who's a longtime volunteer with the American Red Cross, how dependent is the Red Cross on volunteers still today?
Oh, we are so dependent on volunteers. Actually, that is how we mobilize our workforce. Our workforce, we don't have a lot of paid staff here in Iowa. We really depend on volunteers to do that. And in fact, we have over 1,200 volunteers here in Iowa ready to serve in their communities, and they're throughout the entire state. So there really isn't a county that we don't have volunteers in.
And you got involved with the Red Cross through volunteering yourself, right?
I did. You know, I kind of grew up learning how to swim certainly is a big piece of the Red Cross. But I actually have been volunteering as a CPR and first aid instructor and certainly a water safety instructor. But then disaster struck in the community that I was living in. And I was kind of thrown into the deep end of the pool, as we say, and I opened a shelter and helped evacuate a town.
Wow. So, and that was in the summer of 1993 with all
right.
of the flooding?
Yeah. I was in South Dakota at the time.
All right.
And so it was kind of a wild summer.
It was a wild summer here in Iowa, too.
Yeah.
And I do want to bring Nancy into the conversation now, too. Nancy Kittner is a volunteer with the American Red Cross. And Nancy, you also got involved because of a flood, although it was a different flood. It was the 2008 floods in Cedar Rapids, right?
The epic flood in 2008, yes. Yes, hello, Christy. And I got heavily involved with the Red Cross at that time because I wanted to help. And I saw the community in need, and I saw the massive amount of flooding, 10 miles wide, and just in areas that were over the 500-year floodplain, and families in distress. I volunteered starting out at a couple of the shelters, and then I ended up doing client casework, which is just boots on the ground, door to door, making sure that anyone who needs assistance gets it. And one of the first clients I had in that instance was an emergency room nurse at St. Luke's Hospital, and she just never even got to go home for like over a week and a half because Mercy evacuated to St. Luke's, and there was just nowhere to go. The Mercy was underwater, and St. Luke's is closer to the river, and Iowa City's underwater. And so these poor nurses just didn't even have a chance to leave their shifts. And by the time she got there, the only thing she could salvage from her house was a box of ornaments in her attic. And the impact of things like that, just it changes your perspective. And I got very passionately involved with disaster relief at that time. Cedar Rapids was the worst disaster for the American Red Cross since Katrina. A lot of people don't know that. And then we were usurped by Hurricane Sandy, which I also went to and helped with disaster relief there. But so we are still third in line for the worst disaster for the American Red Cross in history. So,
well, and Nancy, I know you've been on 15 different deployments. You mentioned
yes.
Hurricane Sandy,
mm-hmm.
and there have been many other disasters that you've gone to help with. When you go on a deployment, what's that like? What do you do?
I like to think of it as Amazing Race, the best way to describe it, because you fly into a destination you don't necessarily know where you're going to end up and what exactly your function will be, although you have a broad idea and you're going for a certain function, like if you're doing client casework or disaster assessment or those kinds of things. But your location, it's a fluid thing, and a disaster is a very fluid thing, and so you have to be very flexible and So it's interesting. You can end up in a lot of different places. I did Hurricane Irene. When that hit New York, I ended up in Prattville. A little town was the very first victory for the Americans in the Revolutionary War. I Googled the history of it because this town was just so amazing. And it was completely devastated. It was completely wiped out. And one of our first assignments was a mobile home park, and that was like located 2.5 miles from where it should have been. And the devastation was just catastrophic. And
how long did you stay there?
I originally signed up for 3 weeks on that one, and then they asked me to extend for another 3 weeks, so I was actually there for 6 weeks.
When you get called up for a deployment, how long do you have before you leave?
Usually 3 weeks. They like to have 3 weeks because, you know, there's the expense of getting the volunteers there. So they like a commitment for 3 weeks. But then they'll often ask you to extend if you know, you're an integral part of what's going on, and you can. So, but that's up to you. And you get to go when you want to go, and you put your name in the hat to deploy nationally when it's convenient for you and when you're able to. So there's no pressure to go when you can't, but when you can go, they're very grateful to have you. We're 90% volunteer. So American Red Cross is hugely volunteer, and it's very important. And there's things you can do in the state, too, for disaster relief. We have fires every week. We have floods. A couple weeks ago, Clinton had a tornado, and I was loading cases for that. And there was a fire at Loras College, and we had students evacuated there, and we were assisting them. And this was just a couple weeks ago. I did over 20 cases that week, and I felt like I was on a national disaster a couple weeks ago, but it can be that busy, and there's just a lot that can be done here too in the local Red Cross, and our Red Cross in Des Moines is regional, statewide, so we handle cases all over the state and the fires all over the state.
Now, clearly you've had to spend a lot of time away from home.
Yes.
It's very difficult work, and
yes.
Is there one story that you could share with us that kind of illustrates why this is worth it for you?
Oh, there's so many, but the one that always sticks out in my mind is a tornado in Georgia, and we went to help a family, and a little girl is looking at her. Well, in a disaster, all of their belongings end up usually in the street, and this is in Cedar Rapids too. And just front end loaders were coming in and taking like all these people's lives into the garbage, you know, into the garbage trucks, and it's so traumatic. And one little girl wanted to save a toy from the pile of rubble, and flood water is nasty. It's not clean water. It's very toxic and very bad. And she wanted to take a little toy, a little stuffed animal, and she, you know, she couldn't do that because it's contaminated. So the Red Cross was there, and I was there, and we were able to give her a little Mickey Mouse and a toy that she could have that's clean and she could take with her to the shelter. And her mom just cried because she had something that she could give her little 2-year-old daughter. And the mom was a single mom, and these are just so common stories. Families are displaced, and I don't know. I just have a passion for it. Somebody needs to do it, and I'm glad I was born to do it.
Oh, Nancy, that's so wonderful. And Leslie, I mean, we've talked about how many volunteers, the reliance on volunteers with the Red Cross. Again, is this something that has recruitment changed over time? Do you still find that there are as many people willing to step in and do the work that's needed?
Well, it's one of those things that I live every day. We are so fortunate to live in Iowa because people want to help. And even in 1917, they were trying to figure out how to help. And I'm so proud to say in 2016, people are still helping. They still want to step up and do it. And it's just amazing.
Nancy, if you could say something just to people who've maybe given this some thought over the years, what should get them across the threshold if they've considered volunteering for the Red Cross?
You can't give more than you get back. You just can't. And it's its own reward. Its own value is helping people in disasters. You are working with people or the volunteers, your fellow volunteers, at probably the worst time in someone's life. And you're there to help. And there's tangible assistance we can do, and there's mental, physical, and financial assistance, and sheltering, and food. That we supply emergency needs in emergencies in our state and in our nation. And I don't think people fully understand how big the Red Cross is. We're mandated to be there when these disasters happen, and we're there, and we know what we're doing. And I'm just so proud to be an American Red Cross volunteer.
Nancy, thank you so much for talking with us today. Nancy Kintner is a Red Cross volunteer who lives in Des Moines. Leslie Schaefer, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Leslie Schaefer is Regional Executive Director for the American Red Cross. We're going to continue marking this centennial year of the Red Cross in a moment. Kara Kelly, Regional Communications Officer for the American Red Cross, staying with us. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are marking the centennial of the Red Cross in Iowa. And every year, the Red Cross recognizes individual Iowans for their acts of bravery. We're going to take a few minutes to share two of the remarkable Iowans who were recognized this year. Joe Hogan of Altoona is a 2016 Hero of the Heartland. He runs a nonprofit called Train to Inspire, where they help people with mental and physical disabilities work on physical fitness. Producer Emily Woodbury spoke with Joe yesterday about why he started Train to Inspire and why he's focused his efforts on helping the disabled community.
Actually, growing up, I wasn't around anybody with a disability. You know, in school, you have a couple people in your class, but I'd never really witnessed firsthand anybody with a severe and profound disability. I became a personal trainer, obviously because I wanted to change people's lives. I think that's why most people get into it in the beginning. And I was working one day, and a gentleman came in, and he had Noonan syndrome. Now, Noonan syndrome is a fairly, it's a disorder that affects several chromosomes in a body. A lot of the gentlemen, the life expectancy is fairly short. They'll usually be born with club foot. They'll have to wear braces most of their life. And the disability is just very, it's very severe. It's very profound. Well, this gentleman came in to me, and he wanted to start lifting weights, and he wanted to start working out. And at the time, I didn't even really think much about the disability. I looked at it like it was anybody else coming in and asking me for help. So we started working out. We started training, just doing basic things. And at one point in time, this gentleman, Dave Mathis, he spoke to me about how much fun he had when his doctor pushed him in a wheelchair in road races. So, you know, he'd tell these stories and his face would just light up, and you could just tell how happy it made him to be involved in something like that. Because as I said earlier, growing up, society and doctors, family, they tell people with disabilities that, you know, they shouldn't do this or they shouldn't do that because it's not safe, or, you know, something bad could happen, or you're not, basically they're led to believe they're not capable of something like that, even if it's something as simple as running a half marathon or a 5K or a 1 mile race or weightlifting like Dave was doing in the beginning. So basically I asked Dave, you know, what do you think about running your own 5K? What do you think about getting out there and seeing if we can actually get you running? And now, Emily, this is a gentleman that didn't learn to walk till he was 7 years old. And the only time he's actually been in these races is being pushed in a wheelchair. He didn't play sports as a child. And basically, as soon as I said this, this gentleman didn't hesitate at all. He said, man, I'd love to do that. And he looked at me with these eyes. He said, I'd love to do that. So basically, that's where this all started. We started training for this 5K, just a simple run. And here I am. I'm trying to change somebody's life. I'm trying to change this man's life. And what really happened was it was my life that changed. I fell in love with being around individuals with mental and physical disabilities because they're just so powerful. Their personality, their genuineness, they're just so genuine. And you know, they try so hard. You know, typically a personal trainer has to deal with a wide spectrum of clients, and you know, a lot of times it can be hard. People don't want to try, or people don't want to come in. And here's this man with any reason to give up, any reason not to be here, and he shows up every day, and so do so many of our other clients in Train to Inspire. They just are so happy to be there and have the ability to train like everybody else.
And you mentioned how children are certainly not encouraged, but even stopped from doing certain physical activities when they're growing up. And at these Train to Inspire events, you have things like laser tag, paintball, rock wall climbing, and something called a superhero obstacle course.
Yes, Emily. Really, one of the most important things I try to do with Train to Inspire is we try to do what everybody else isn't doing. And basically, the events that we do monthly, aside from the personal training, we do something every month basically to push their limits. And like the superhero obstacle course, that was something that we modified specifically for people with disabilities. But now when you hear me say that, you probably think in your mind something that's going to be fairly easy. And almost, to be honest with you, you probably think something, something childish. And that is absolutely not what we did for the obstacle course. I specifically designed obstacles. I built most of them myself. I had a few friends help me. I live in Altoona, and the volunteer base there is just so great, so amazing. I don't know what I'd do without all the help there. But we built these obstacles to push them. We built everything. Obviously, everything's safe, but we built it because I wanted them to have to try to do it. I didn't want to make anything easy. I made them struggle over walls. I made them struggle through tunnels. They had to lift things up, flip tires, just all kinds of crazy things that they have never done in their life. And every single one of them did it.
Joe, you have been honored by the Red Cross. You were one of the 2016 Heroes of the Heartland. What does that mean to you?
You know, it's an honor to be recognized by the Red Cross for such an award. I don't know that I really look at myself like a hero, though. In my eyes, the people that I work with are the heroes, actually. And, I contacted the Red Cross when I found out. And I told him pretty much exactly what I'm telling you. And I asked him if I could buy another 30 awards to hand out to all my participants, the adults and children with mental and physical disabilities. So I'm going to give the awards to the people that actually deserve it. And that's them for the impact that they've had on my life.
That's Joe Hogan talking with producer Emily Woodbury. He's one of the Heroes of the Heartland honorees for this year and the founder of the organization Train to Inspire. And with me now is Trey Rice of Grimes. He's another 2016 Hero of the Heartland, recognized for saving a young boy from drowning. Hello, Trey.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And I want to go back to last summer, Sunday, July 12th, 2015. Tell me what happened.
It was just a regular Sunday. Me and some friends thought we'd go float the river. It was my second time doing it, so I really didn't know what we were getting into. And we put in at Pucker Brush with the family of Ethan and just started floating the river. And the river was pretty high that day. And we stopped before the I-80 Bridge on a sandbar just to hang out. And that's when we watched the family go by, and about 5 minutes went by, and me and one of my friends, Austin Matter, noticed something wasn't quite right down at the bridge, so we started walking down towards the bridge, and that's when we heard screams for help, and took off running, jumped in the river upstream. The current was pretty strong, so we got back to shore, and that's when I jumped in to the debris under the bridge and climbed over to him.
So you heard the screams when you ran down there and looked at the situation. What did you see?
We could see there was someone in the water. We'd see him for about 2 or 3 seconds, and then he'd go back under the water behind a log for a minute. And once we got to him, he was underwater and then came back up and finally kind of got launched onto a branch. And that's when I ran and jumped in, and it took me a little bit to get over to him. But once I did, we took a little bit to get out of there, but we finally got it out of the riptide or rip current.
Right. When you saw he wasn't wearing a life jacket.
And, that is correct.
And you could see him struggling. So the first time you jumped in the river, you just went right past him, right?
No. Almost. We thankfully got back to shore before we passed him. And then that's when I really just wasn't thinking and kind of took a sprint and a leap. And thankfully there's debris under the water. We couldn't see that. I caught myself on to climb over to him. And that's when I noticed he was stuck in one of those rip currents that pulls you under. And I'd always heard about those, but never believed in them till then.
Wow. What was going through your head?
A lot of adrenaline. Just, we got to get out of this situation. Wasn't quite sure how we were going to do that.
Had you ever had any kind of life-saving training or anything?
No, I had not.
So this was just pure instinct for you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of just happened.
So you got him to shore, and I know you said that his head kept going underwater. Was he okay once he was on the shore?
Yes, he was fine, more scared than anything.
I'm sure everybody was scared. When you took a moment to think about how you were feeling, how were you feeling?
I kind of laid on a sandbar there for a minute, like out of breath, trying to catch my breath.
Wow. And when did it hit you, the enormity of what had just happened? You saved his life.
Probably like a day or two later when I was seeing it on the news and stuff. And I was like, wow, that wasn't a dream.
How does that change how you think about yourself?
I did what anyone would have done in that situation, I think. But definitely going to think about going in water twice from now on.
Does it change your outlook on life at all?
Yeah, don't take life for granted, that's for sure.
Getting this award is a really special opportunity, and it's interesting listening to Joe Hogan talking about it, listening to you. It sounds like a lot of the people who get these awards think, well, I was just doing
just doing
what I should have done.
Right place at the right time, I guess.
How does it feel to be recognized for that?
It's a true honor because I've always been a huge fan and believer in the American Red Cross. And actually, in kindergarten, I sung at Heroes of the Heartland when I was at Hy-Vee Hall. And I always thought it was extremely cool. It'd be sweet to be one of those people up there getting an award. And I was like, oh, wow.
Now you are.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Trey, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Trey Rice of Grimes, another one of the 2016 Heroes of the Heartland, recognized for saving a young boy from drowning. And Kara Kelly is still with us, Regional Communications Officer for the American Red Cross. And Kara, why do you think Heroes of the Heartland is important for the Red Cross?
Well, I think it really gives us an opportunity to highlight and showcase the amazing things that our people are doing in our communities. And, you know, it never fails that all of our honorees are humble and they don't believe that they're doing anything that anybody else would do. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. And so it really is exciting and an opportunity for us to say thank you and to give these people the recognition they deserve.
Now, I know that you've already had one of your recognition banquets so far. You have several more coming up around the state of Iowa. You try to make sure that you get in all the corners of the state.
That's correct. So we have 5 Heroes of the Heartland celebrations throughout the state. We honored 21 amazing individuals in Dubuque on St. Patrick's Day on March 17th. Central Iowa Heroes of the Heartland event is Friday, April 8th in the morning. And then we will recognize people in the northwestern corner of the state in Sioux City on April 14th. And then we'll go to Ottumwa on April 22nd. And then we have a different kind of celebration, but still talks about the amazing things that people are doing in our community. And that's the Red Boa Ball. And that's in Cedar Rapids on April 30th. And these are also fundraisers for the American Red Cross.
Now, in celebrating the centennial of the Red Cross in Iowa, what special things do you have planned?
Well, we'll do a lot and talk a lot about the centennial at our Heroes events. And we actually have a very cool historical timeline that we've put together with some artifacts from Iowa that will travel to each of these events. Next month is National Volunteer Month. So look for some features about our Iowa volunteers on our website, redcross.org/IA. We'll have some cool things at the Iowa State Fair at our first aid stations. We are probably going to have some historical Clara Bartons that people can take their picture with for the centennial at the State Fair this year. So we're excited about that.
And so then, wait, that's people dressed up like Clara Barton or cardboard cutouts of Clara Barton?
Well, I think it's going to be cardboard cutouts, but wow, would it be cool to have people dressed up as Clara?
Well, maybe for the sesquicentennial.
I'll have to see if I can convince our volunteers to don their hoop skirts for me. And then in November, we're asking people to turn the state red for the American Red Cross. So whether it's turning your lights red or wearing red or showing some support for the American Red Cross in November to really make sure that we can continue the Red Cross for another 100 years and even longer than that.
Now, talking earlier with Nancy and Leslie, they spoke so highly of all of the volunteers that do work with the Red Cross. How do you get the word out to people? Because, I mean, you can help in small ways, you can help in large ways, but some of these volunteer efforts are really significant commitments. How do you find those people?
Well, I mean, a lot of times you look for people who might be retired and are looking for something to do now that they have more time on their hands. You know, it is a hard thing to sell for some people to say you're going to be away from your family for 2 to 3 weeks. But I will tell you, for every person that goes, they go again probably dozens more times because they're so inspired and they feel they get so much out of helping people. But it doesn't to work with the Red Cross, to volunteer with the Red Cross doesn't take a huge time commitment. There are a lot of different things that you can do. It can be as simple as coming with us to install smoke alarms in people's homes or to show people how to create a fire escape plan. We do a training class with children that's about an hour long called the Pillowcase Project and teaches kids about disaster preparedness and what they need to have in their emergency kit. We have some folks who just come in and answer the phones in the office to help dispatch disaster calls. So it doesn't take a huge commitment. You might even have an opportunity at your local veteran center or at the VA hospital. There's lots of different facets of the Red Cross, and there are a lot of different ways to get involved. So it's just about picking up the phone and calling your local office or getting online and starting the application and finding the best fit for you.
Do you find that there are some misconceptions about the Red Cross out there? Do you find that people are surprised by all the things you do?
I think people don't quite grasp how often we respond to home fires, which is the number one disaster in the state of Iowa. And I think people sometimes forget that that's something that we do. A lot of times, if there's a lot of blood drives in a community, that's really what people think about. They think about blood drives. And you forget about the Red Cross sometimes when there isn't a large disaster, like a large hurricane or a large tornado outbreak. But, you know, the Red Cross is here for disasters large and small. We're in your communities and we're there to help you in your time of need. And hopefully you don't need us, but we're trained and ready if you do.
Kara, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Kara Kelly is Regional Communications Officer for the American Red Cross, and the American Red Cross is marking its centennial year in Iowa. It was begun in Iowa in 1916, or brought to Iowa in 1916, and there will be events throughout the year, as you heard Kara saying. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @IPRTalk. I'm there too @CharityNebbie. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.